a Christian European kingdom and give up their nomadic ways. So in this lecture, I propose to look at first the Magyars and the Pecheneks, two groups that I have discussed previously who are responsible for disrupting the Khazar Khanate. In addition, we will be looking at Rus, Scandinavians from Sweden. They are not steppe nomads, to be sure, but they play an extremely important role in the reconfiguration of the steppes in the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries. Furthermore, they will be the Byzantine success. They will convert to Orthodox Christianity and lay the foundations of Russia, and it will be the Russians in time, starting in the 16th century, who will end the power of the nomadic tribes on the steppes, the Eurasian steppes, literally from the forest zones of Russia to Manchuria. And finally, we'll bring a third group on known as the Cumans, who are Turks, who will close this lecture. So we have three nomadic peoples, some wayward Vikings, the Byzantine Empire, the kingdoms of Hungary and Russia. So we've got a tall order in this lecture. Well, let's turn to the Magyars first. They are significant for several reasons. First, they are not Turkish speakers. They're virtually the only significant nomadic people of the Middle Ages who are not Turks. And they originated in the forest zones, the taiga, as the Russians would call it, more or less to the northeast of the Urals. Their ancestors clearly go back into the Bronze Age, and they dwelled in forest areas where they exploited the fur trade. They are involved in fishing and hunting. And it's an important point to note that throughout the history of the steppes, there is always this interaction between forest peoples and nomadic peoples. And sometimes forest people become nomads, as in the case of the Magyars. In other cases, there are certain Turkish groups that return to or adopt a forest life. Actually, in his early career, Temujin, the future Genghis Khan, does retreat into the steppes to avoid his enemy, into the forests to avoid his enemies, and pursues a life that would have been very similar to that of the Magyars. The Magyars, at some point between the 5th and the 8th centuries AD, moved out onto the grasslands and adopted a nomadic way of life. They did not speak Turkish. They did speak an agglutinative language related to Turkish. It's known as the Finno-Ugrian language. This is a language family that today includes Hungarian, that is the language of the Magyars, the language of the Finns, the Suomi, as they call themselves, the Lapps to the north, and also the Estonians. It is remotely related to Turkish. Modern Turks would claim that, oh, the Magyars speak a form of Turkish. Well, that's not really quite correct. And the Magyars would correct you very quickly on that. We're not a bunch of wayward Turks. We do speak a distinct language, which they have retained, even though they settled in Central Europe and are surrounded by Slavic and Germanic-speaking peoples. The Magyars, therefore, are a very good example of how people move between the forest zones and the steppes and will change their lifestyle depending on circumstance. And once they moved onto the steppes, they acquired many of the same habits, the stock raising, the importance of animals. They gained, by the early medieval period, all of the trappings of steppe cavalry, that is the horse archer, the types of armaments that we've discussed with the Turks in their clashes with the Tang emperors of China, and the same type of equipment that we discussed with Avars and Bulgars and Khazars who came into contact with the Byzantines. The Magyars, therefore, in many ways looked like a nomadic people. It's just that their language was somewhat different. They, too, were organized into a very loose confederacy, and initially they apparently recognized the authority of the Ashina Khan of the Khazars. That is, they were vassals. They were probably regarded as outer tribes. Well, something put them in motion. Somewhere around the mid-9th century, we suspect around 850 AD, we're drawing this from Byzantine and Arabic sources, and they began to move to the southwest from their original homes and ended up on the South Russian steppes in the valleys of the Don and the Dnieper rivers. Their migration is very indicative of the structure of these nomadic confederations. Technically, they were vassals of the Khan of the Khazars, but apparently this migration was taken on their own initiative for their own reasons. It could have been simply a matter of finding better pastures, and they move very rapidly. And I've mentioned this in previous lectures. When a nomadic group decides to move, they can move great distances very quickly and find new pastures and homelands. And within 15 years, that new home has become the ancestral home. Clearly, this is what happened with the Magyars. They moved into this zone of southern Russia, just to the north of the Black Sea, and now regarded that as their ancestral home and regrouped themselves into a loose confederation of seven tribes. They also more or less shook off their loyalty to the Khan of the Khazars and were seen as a very, very a difficult and undisciplined group of barbarians who started to raid the Balkans, attacking the Bulgars, annoying the Byzantines, especially their settlement at Sherzan. And in 839, the Emperor Theophilus, one of my favorite Byzantine emperors, by the way, his wife was chosen to him in a bride show, compliments of the Khazar court as an inspiration. And Theophilus sent military engineers and technicians to the Khan of the Khazars to build a fortress on the Don. Sarkal is its name, and it has apparently been uncovered by Russian archaeologists or Soviet archaeologists at the time. And it was a fortress that was set up to control and inhibit the movement of Magyars eastward into the heartland of the Khazar domains. There are Islamic sources that also confirm that the Magyars and Khazars have come to loggerheads. They're fighting and raiding each other, probably to feed the slave trade and probably to reward their followers. But it's indicative that already in the mid-9th century, the Khazar Khanate is under pressure and starting to break up. The Magyars, therefore, were a new dimension in imperial diplomacy. And they ironically get pushed west into their future home of Hungary by a miscalculation in Byzantine diplomacy. They are moved around in the complicated wars between Tsar Simeon of the Bulgarians at this point and the Byzantine Emperor Leo VI, and they are attacked by another group called the Pecheneks, who are a new Turkish tribe we'll introduce in a moment. And in the winter of 895-896, because of this diplomatic mistake in a Byzantine-Bulgarian war, the Magyars cross the Carpathians and settle in their future homeland around Budapest. That is, they take over the grasslands that we've often called the Pannonian Plains or sometimes the Hungarian Plains. And starting in 897, they become a general nuisance to the Western Europeans. Magyars begin to raid into Italy, into Western Europe. They attack what we call the Holy Roman Empire, that is the Germanic half of the old Carolingian Empire that has the imperial title of Charlemagne. And it isn't until 955 when the Holy Roman Emperor Otto I defeats the Magyars at a decisive battle at the Lech, and forces the Magyars to accept boundaries and stop raiding. Within a generation, the Magyars come under very, very strong missionary influence, and they convert to Latin Christianity, not to Byzantine Christianity. They embrace the Catholic faith. Their King Stephen, who rules from 1000 to 1038, very often known as Saint Stephen, as a saintly king, he begins the transformation of the Magyars into the Hungarians, into the Kingdom of Hungary, and henceforth these people would play a major role in European history, but they have forgotten their steppe ways, they have renounced them, and they have become part of wider Christendom. In fact, the Hungarian Kingdom has become the bastion of Western Europe against future attacks by nomads to the east, Pecheneks, Cumans, and they will take the full brunt of the Mongol attack in the 13th century. One significant note about the Hungarians were identified with Huns, Hunoi, by both Byzantine and German chroniclers, and the Hungarians actually like that. Their real name is Magyar, but they're called Huns, which means they're kind of Hungarians, they're Huns, And they claim some kind of connection to Attila. The later kings of Hungary, the so-called Arpad kings, claim to have the original sword of Attila, which is now in Vienna. It's passed through various families with the marriage alliances of the Habsburgs. And the name Attila, for instance, is a very common name among Hungarians. In addition, they were apparently regarded as Ugor or Uruguay, various names in Greek and Latin sources, from which the word ogre comes from. Because to the Germans, these people were such violent attackers, they'd never witnessed steppe nomads before, they called them ogres, and that word passed into general European languages. Well, with the Magyars off the stage as steppe nomads and being turned into Christian Hungarians, let us look at how they got there, and that brings us to the second group of nomadic peoples, the Pecheneks. The Pecheneks are known by a variety of names. I've chosen that one. It's the most common used in Byzantine sources. Patsenex is another term used for them. They were clearly Turkish speakers. And in fact, they seem to speak a Turkish language that would be closely related to modern Turkish in Turkey, Azerbaijani, and the language of Turkmenistan, where some of these other Turkish people, such as the Bulgars, the Khazars, spoke a distinct Lir or Western branch of Turkish, which is now largely extinct. In any case, they were pushed west because they had dwelled probably just north of the Jaxartes River. They were part of the coalition or confederation of the Western Gurk Turks, going back to that great Khanate that was established in the 6th century AD, that was subjected by the Chinese emperors of the Tang Dynasty, that reasserted its independence, and that will clash with the armies of Islam. Well, sometime in the 9th century, they were pushed west in the typical domino movements by a new group of Turks known as the Oyuz Turks, or as they're sometimes called, the Guz, which is the Arabic name for them, but Oyuz would be the Turkish name. And these are the ancestors, the immediate ancestors of the Seljuk Turks, who will have such an important impact on the Islamic world and medieval history in general. That is, these kinsmen, the Oyuz Turks, dispossessed the Pecheneks of their ancestral lands north of the Jaxartes, around the Aral Sea, and they began to migrate west. They followed the same routes that the Huns would have followed, and probably the Sarmatians before them. And that brought them to the rivers Ural and Volga and into the orbit of the Khazar Khans. And again, about 25 years later than the Magyars, less than a generation, they cross just north of Khazar domains and descend upon the Magyars and are responsible for dislodging and pushing those Magyars west into Central Europe. And again, I stress that the Khazar Khan had very little control over these people. They were able to move pretty much at will, and it's because these steppe confederations are a loose arrangement of inner and outer tribes, and no Khan really exercises authority such as a bureaucratic state in the Tang China, the Byzantine Empire, or as we shall see, the Abbasid Caliphate. That the control is much looser. It involves submissions by the leaders, that is the lesser Khans, Yabgular, as they would be called in the plural, the Abgu, that is the subordinate rulers, to the great Khan, furnishing tribal armies on request and obeying the general directives. But on a day-to-day basis, these nomadic confederations really don't influence the pattern of life for many of the tribes, and the Pecheneks were happy to move across the domains of the outer tribes of the Khans, of the Khazar Khanate, and descend into the regions between the Don and the Dnieper. They not only dislodged the Magyars, they got a reputation of being the most pitiless and dangerous of nomadic conquerors, far more dangerous than the Khazars, and the Byzantine emperors had very mixed opinions about them. On the one hand, they were extremely useful, and Pechenek horse archers appear in imperial armies in the 10th and 11th centuries. They were completely impervious to Christianity. Both Western missionaries coming from Germany, Byzantine missionaries, had absolutely no success with these people. The best that the emperor in Constantinople could hope for was that his governor at Sherzan in the Crimea would attend the traditional festivals of the Pechenegs each spring, watch them string up and slaughter some wolves, and hope that the Pechenegs did not attack imperial territory. Particularly in the later 10th century when the Byzantines have regained control of most of the Balkans and have subjected the Bulgarians to their authority. In addition, the Pechenegs warred with the Khazars, and they came to an agreement with a third group of people who are not steppe nomads, but whom I mentioned earlier in this lecture. Those are the Rus. These would be Swedes, some Danes and Finns and other people from Scandinavia, who had been trading with the Khazars, for at least 150 years. Archaeology indicates that in the beginning of the 8th century AD, Swedes moved across the Baltic and used the river systems of Russia to get into contact with either the world of Islam, and that seems to have been the first trade route, along the Volga down to the Caspian Sea, or later to take a combination of routes that would lead you to the Dnieper, that great river that now essentially cuts across the Ukraine in a great bend, and then go to the Black Sea and to Constantinople. These trade routes were ancient. They were the same routes that brought Goths from Scandinavia onto the steppes in the 3rd century AD and led to that amalgam of Goths and nomadic Sarmatians who had attacked the Roman Empire in the 3rd century and were again reduced to allies of Rome in the 4th century. And so this represented effectively a second migration out of the Baltic. In addition, these Scandinavians had superb ships that could negotiate the rivers of Russia, both warships and merchant ships. But in order to negotiate those rivers, they had to come to terms with existing peoples. Now, initially in the 8th and early 9th century, these Swedes, collectively known as Rus, arrived as merchant princes, mercenaries, visitors on the Volga at the permission of the Khazar Khan. But starting around 860, and we are told this wonderfully fanciful story in the Russian Primary Chronicle, written in the early 12th century, a Viking warlord named Rurik, perhaps a Slavic rendition of Eric, established a trading post at Holmgard, the future Novgorod, and then his subordinates, his jarls, established another position down at the modern city of Kiev, and they developed a new route along the Dnieper that took them to Constantinople. Their intention was probably to cut out the Khazar middlemen and get directly to the silks and gold of Constantinople, whereas with the Khazars, they were exporting slaves and furs through Atil and being taxed by the Khan. And so this new route gave the Rus a direct beeline to Constantinople. However, to exploit this route, they had to come to terms with the Pechenegs. And the Pechenegs were happy to do this. They controlled the steppes. All Rus ships would have to navigate very treacherous rapids down at the lower end of the Dnieper River. The boats would have to make portage. That is, they'd have to be moved up from the river and moved around. And the Pechenegs controlled this. And if you weren't on good terms with these guys, they're going to wipe you out. And as you know, as steppe nomads, they're always interested in collecting tableware. That is, the severed heads of their defeated opponents. And as a result, there was essentially an understanding between the Rus and the Pechenegs through much of the 10th century to cooperate in the trade connections down to Constantinople. Four times the Rus launched fleets to attack Constantinople, starting in 860. The last one was in 941. And these extorted commercial treaties out of the emperor in Constantinople. They also engaged in slave trading and the fur trade. And furs and slaves were exacted from the Slavic peoples of the forests. And the Rus happily sold these slaves to Pechenegs and other Turkish tribes because that labor was needed in the Islamic world. So close was the alliance that sometime after 967, somewhere in there, The Pechenegs and Rus teamed up to sack the city of Atal, that is the capital of the Khazar Khan. The date is a little uncertain, but it probably is before 967, because in that year, the Rus prince, his name is Sviatoslav, got it in his head to attack Bulgaria and Constantinople, and he was eventually defeated. And he was actually wiped out by his Pechenek allies on his way back to Russia, and his head got to join the collection of the Pechenek Khan of all the goblets he's collected from his opponents. There was a significant change in the relationship in 988-989. In that year, the then reigning prince of the Rus at Kiev, named Vladimir, or Valdemar, to use his Norse name, converted to Orthodox Christianity. This was the significant second success of Byzantine missionaries. They had converted the Bulgars, turned them into Bulgarians. They now converted the Rus and turned them into Slavic-speaking Russians, professing the Orthodox faith and looking to Constantinople as a model to set up a literate, urban-based civilization in the forest zones of Russia. Now, that was a very significant turning point, and it influenced very much the relationship between these Rus, now called Russians, to designate them as quite distinct from their pagan Scandinavian ancestors. These Russian princes, who claimed descent from Rurik, and right down into the end of the 16th century, every ruler was somehow in Russia was from the Russian cities, was descended from Rurik. Nonetheless, they ruled as a Slavic Byzantine-style king, a Christian monarch who adopted the laws of Constantinople, which is essentially Roman law, who began to build churches in Byzantine fashion, who fortified their posts into incipient cities with stockades, the most significant change is now, as Christian monarchs, they could not sell their Slavic subjects, who were increasingly Christians, as slaves to Turkish nomads. That was out. They were only allowed to oppress them as Russian serfs. So that meant the slave trade suddenly dried up in the 10th and 11th century for the Pechenegs as well as other nomadic peoples. And the result was, well, if you're not going to trade, the Pechenegs are going to raid. And starting in the 11th century, you get a constant battle along the steppe zone between the Russians and the Pechenegs. And the Pechenegs are trying to raid and supply the slave market of the Islamic world. And the Russians, of course, want to prevent that. Efforts to convert the Pechenegs, as well as later Turks who come after them, the Cumans, prove hopeless. And I always think one of the problems is that not only are they nomads, and Orthodox Christianity requires the cities and urban organization of essentially a Byzantine-style state, but the Pechenegs and the later Cumans and even the Mongols, when they arrive, they're on the hashish side of the vodka hashish line. That is, if you live in the Russian steppes and you drink vodka to get through the winter, you're going to go Christian. If, on the other hand, you're on the steppes you have your shamans who are in communication with the other world, we'll talk about why Islam was so impressive to the Turks. They would identify Muslim Sufi mystics as shamans, and they would use a bit of hashish to mount the world tree and get a vision of the mystical world. Well, you're more likely to go over to Islam. Now, it might be something of a silly comparison, yet, on the other hand, this connection is actually made by the Russian Primary Chronicle as one of the reasons for convincing the Rus that, at that point, Scandinavians, who will then adopt the Orthodox Church and the Slavic Rite, for going over to Orthodox Christianity. And the result is that the Byzantines have created in the forest zone a set of Russian principalities, which in time will play a decisive role in the history of the steppes, but that will come in the 16th century and later. Meanwhile, the Pechenegs now found themselves at odds with the Russians, the Russian principalities, with the Hungarian kings. There was actually an effort by the Hungarian kings, now Christians, to convert nomadic peoples. That went nowhere. And in addition, with the emperors in Constantinople. Well, in 1087, there is a report that 80,000 Pechenegs, apparently the fighting force of the Pechenek Confederation, crossed the Danube and entered imperial territory. They were pressing in the direction of Constantinople. The reasons for their movement are a bit uncertain, but in part they were being pressed by a new group of Turks who occupied the former domains of the Khazar Khan, and they are known as Cumans. They, too, were being forced west. They were Kipchak Turks, as we'd call them. Kipchak Turks will play a very decisive role in the Mongol period, and they likewise were being pressed west by the Guz or the Oyuz Turks, that is, the ancestors of the Seljuk Turks. And so they moved into the domains of the former Khazar Khans and clashed with the Pecheneks over the right to raid Russia and collect slaves. And in 1087, the Pecheneks decided to migrate into the Balkans. Well, this was a nightmare for the then Emperor Alexis I, who came to the throne in 1081 and died in 1118. And he is desperately trying to hold his empire together. He has lost Asia Minor to the Seljuk Turks. We'll discuss that in a later lecture. And the Balkan provinces were essentially the only areas he still had. Alexis summoned a huge Cuman army into the Balkans to help defeat this invasion because he had visions of the Pecheneks laying siege to Constantinople, contacting the Seljuk Turks, particularly the emir of Izmir named Chanka, and once again Constantinople would be besieged by an army from Asia Minor and a nomadic army from Central Europe. This had happened with the Avars back in 626. They had cooperated with the Persians. The Bulgars had cooperated with the Arabs back in 717. And these invasions were warded off by parading the Hoda Getria, that is the icon of Mary Theotokos, the ward of the patron of the city, and the Byzantine fleet. And to prevent that, he called in a Cuman army. And together, a Cuman-Byzantine army in 1091 maneuvered this Pechenek migration, this reputedly 80,000 Pecheneks, and wiped them out. It took place at the Battle of Luvunium. It is near the modern Greek-Turkish border. And the result was the Byzantines now replaced the Pecheneks with the Cumans. It was the last success in Byzantine diplomacy, because after that, the Byzantine Empire is essentially ruined by the Crusaders and sacked in 1204. The Cumans fall heirs to the Western steppes. They are pagans, they are Turkish speakers, and they are keen in exploiting that slave trade, fur trade, to the Islamic world. They run smack up against the Russian principalities, these Byzantine-style states in the forest zones that are not going to trade their subjects as slaves to the Cumans. And so what happens, the Russian states, the various Russian principalities at Kiev, Suzdal, Cherniganov, Novgorod, the Republic of Novgorod, Psukhov, they all end up assuming the Byzantine role of dealing with Turkish nomads on the steppes. And it ends in essentially an equilibrium. Through much of the 12th and early 13th century, there's constant fighting going back and forth between the Russians and the Cumans. The Russians adopt many of the cavalry techniques of the Cumans, and we have a remarkable epic. One of the earliest pieces of vernacular Russian known as the Lay of Prince Igor. Prince Igor was apparently a historical figure of the 11th century. And it is really in a kind of archaic prose that has the cadence of poetry. And it talks of how Prince Igor battles and fights, is captured by the Cumans, and eventually